My name's Dan Doherty, and I'm a late bloomer. I didn't really start reading or caring about the life of the mind all that much until my late 20s. And then I was a really slow reader once I did, so then I was just real frustrated because I wanted to catch up on all the things that I had missed, and it was really hard for me to. But most of my... most of my career or careers trajectory has been characterized by a motivation to help people like me to fall in love with the education that I wished I would have had. And that's taken me various places, one of which was here in Rochester for 12 years. I taught at Schaefer Academy, the classical Christian school named after Francis Schaefer. And hi, Daniel. Good to see you. I taught philosophy and literature and composition there. And then more recently, I am the director of Alcuin Study Center. One of the Christian Study Centers is part of the Consortium of Christian Study Centers. It's named after Alcuin of York, and we are in Muncie, Indiana, adjacent to Ball State University.
Since I've been there, I've been working with a lot of faculty. I've been talking a lot with faculty there, and all these questions that were being raised at this conference are questions on the faculty's mind, especially Christian faculty there. And so my career has not yet taken me into the college classroom. I've never taught in a college classroom, full disclosure. So here I am talking about higher education. I've never taught in one of these buildings. I have taught, and I am working directly with many professors and having these discussions. So I'm not coming at you today thinking I've got all these great answers. I do have, I think, what are the beginnings of a good conversation. That's what I'm hoping to have, is just get a conversation going. And I'm very hopeful, actually. I might have a little slightly different take or tone based on conversations with these faculty that I've been meeting with, not just at Ball State, but at other universities, especially in Indiana, but elsewhere as well, and through the consortium of study centers. And I have a fairly hopeful take. So, but again, I'm hoping that we can have some discussion on that. Before I move on here, this is Ball State. The far left building there is the library. It's built to look like a bunch of books on a shelf. Isn't that cool? And then this tower here is named Schaefer Tower. Not the same Schaefer, but nonetheless, it's Schaefer Tower, which is kind of neat. So the title of my talk here is For the Welfare of the University. Oh, that's doing something fun. Okay. For the Welfare of the University. The university was like in college font, you know, that you'd see. But anyway, finding ways to fill the gaps in higher education. And we've already talked a lot about this kind of major gap, right? The most obvious one is the gap in the foundation. What I want to do here is talk about some other gaps, right? This is the capital M meaning gap, but there are other gaps. They're all related. But if the foundation's shaking and cracking, we've got these like stair step cracks. We had water damage in our basement once. I don't know if you know we have stair step cracks going up that are things like economic, ideological, civil, emotional, and we're going to talk about some of these. But these are all cracks that are going on throughout the university that are being noticed by, not just by Christians who are concerned about the foundation, but by everybody, or by a lot of people anyway. And so that gives me actually a lot of hope. There are a lot of people who are saying, yeah, something's wrong. Not sure quite what it is. And we're all pointing right now. Today we've been hearing a lot of pointing at like, well, the foundation's broken. Well, it's been broken quite a while, and no one's been yelling about it yet. But they're calling it out now. People are noticing there are cracks, right? And we'll get to some co-belligerents, as Schaefer called them, later. There are three main parts to what I want to talk about. And the first part is our posture. And so I'm going to kind of give a background more. This is more of a theological background of what I think is helpful for us to keep in mind as Christians, and something that I think we don't do a great job, or haven't done a great job of keeping in mind, necessarily. Let me read this quote from Edward Long, Jr. He wrote a book called Higher Education as Moral Enterprise 30 years ago. And he said this, "Instead of more polemics, we need more reconceptualizing of higher education. Instead of focusing our attention on what is wrong, we need to articulate what the academy looks like when it functions aright." Now, many have attempted to make such an articulation for the last 30 years, and the ship has yet to right itself. But I'm hopeful that perhaps the academy, as we know it, as I said, is ever more ready to admit its need for help, even from unlikely quarters. Long continues, "Alas, the very discontent with the academy that prompts attacks upon its present condition makes the prospect of moral reconceptualization enormously difficult. People can respond to attacks without having to forge any understanding of what ought to be the guiding goal of learning, but they cannot move forward, they cannot move toward constructive alternatives without espousing a set of guiding ideals to which they are committed. While it seems contrary to the spirit of the time to make a compelling case for a positive vision of educational purpose, we must enter into creative conversation to arrive at a perspective that will enable the academic guild and the wider public to embrace the goals of higher education as it ought to be pursued. Only as we discuss these matters within a community of dialogue will higher education become a moral enterprise that people cherish as a foundational element of well-being, a foundational social element of well-being." We're talking about the common good here, right? Peter's talk here, that history, great stuff. We're going to kind of dovetail into some of that. But right now we're talking about this idea of the common good. And the common good is such that it's not individual. It's not like I can say, well, for my human flourishing, I'm going to take away from your human flourishing. Right? No, it can't. That's not common good anymore. Right? So it's not a zero-sum game. And it makes me think, this whole thing makes me think quite a bit of Jeremiah 29. And this is one of our framing foundational ideas that I wanted to get across today. These are the words of the letter that Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the surviving elders of the exiles, and to the priests, the prophets, and all the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had taken into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. "Thus says the Lord, the host, the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon." Now this is his preface to this letter that he sends right after exile, and Daniel would have read it, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego probably would have read it, certainly got the ideas, right? How do we live in exile? And of course, what he goes on to say is make placards, picket a lot, and engage in culture wars, right? That's, I think, what... No, that's not what he says. Here's what he says, right? He says, "Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage, that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease, but seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare." The common good. Peter, in his letters, also addresses the exiles in Asia Minor, with a very similar posture. Live such good lives among the pagans, right, that they'll glorify God on the day of his return. Okay, so bracket that for a minute, hang on to that idea, and let's listen. Harry Lewis, former dean of Harvard College, says of his own institution, as well as other, all of higher education, he says, "Universities have lost the sense that their educational mission is to transform teenagers into adults with the learning and wisdom to take responsibility for their own lives and for civil society." Common good.
When did he live?
20th century. Pretty recent. He's not still there, but he's still alive. And then lastly, if we can, I'm going to go back. Let me read the whole quote from Eliot, and then I'll highlight that one section. But T.S. Eliot, now this was back mid-century, probably 1943-ish. He said it, in his lecture, The Aims of Education, T.S. Eliot says, "If we see a new mysterious machine, I think that the first question we ask is, what's the machine for? And afterward we ask, how does it do it? But the moment we ask about the purpose of anything, we may be involving ourselves in asking about the purpose of everything. If we define education, we are led to ask, what is man? And if we define the purpose of education, we are committed to the question, what is man for? Every definition of the purpose of education, therefore, implies some concealed or rather implicit philosophy or theology," which I think Peter did a great job of illustrating that in his last lecture. "In choosing one definition rather than another, we are attracted to the one because it fits in better with our answer to the question, what is man for?" So that's the question, right? What is man for? What is man? What is man for? Now, let's look briefly at, again, my university. This is my alma mater. It's also where Alcuin Study Center is located. Not in that building. That would be really neat. But that's actually the art museum on campus, the David Owsley Museum of Art. And it's where I graduated. You walk up these steps. That's where that terrace there is where they do our graduation. Ball State was originally a teacher's college in Indiana. It's growing. It's now growing to a research university of 22,000 students and boasts one of the nation's top architecture schools, as well as housing one branch of IU School of Medicine and a world-class art museum. And its mission statement is this: "We engage students in educational, research, and creative endeavors that empower our graduates to have fulfilling careers and meaningful lives, enriched by lifelong learning and service. While we enhance the economic, environmental, and social vitality of our community, our state, and our world." Look at that and tell me what comes to mind. What questions maybe arise for you?
What is a meaningful life?
Yes, what is a meaningful life? Good. What else?
What a job.
Yeah.
Fulfilling careers.
But what is a fulfilling career? We know what a career is, and we know what a high-paying career is. What's a fulfilling career? But how is that defined?
Depends on the person.
It does, doesn't it? Right? I love the enhance vitality. They've got a bunch of types of vitality in there, but vitality is life, right? Enhance life. What all goes into that? And our community. Who is our community? Is anybody left out of our community? Does our community include our churches? All kinds of questions. And it comes back again to, what does it mean to be human? What is a human being for? Now, as Christians, we should know the answer to this. But it seems that over the past century or so, we've lost sight of it. And I'm not sure if this next portion of the talk is super necessary in this setting. After all, I think anybody who's at a LaBrie conference probably has wrestled with this question. But it doesn't hurt to review. And this biblical framework that I'm about to give is the backdrop, along with that Jeremiah passage. It's the backdrop for everything else I'm going to present here, as well as for the entire mission. It's the presuppositional grounding of what we do at Alcuin Study Center. What does it mean to be human? What's a human being for? Well, for the past century or more, the evangelical church has largely, I would argue, failed at answering this question. Christian ministry, and hence the all-consuming occupation of faithful evangelicals, was to share the gospel, by which was meant what? Tell people they are sinners and they can know Jesus personally and have personal piety. That's fine, as far as it goes. Bad news, then the good news. You're a sinner, receive Jesus, and you'll not only escape hell, but you'll have personal piety. But it's not the whole thing by any means. That's just two chapters of what I would call a four-chapter gospel. Right, anybody familiar with that language? Some others use this language? No. So, two chapters versus four chapters. Well, these are the middle two chapters. By beginning with this bad news. You're a sinner. It's no wonder that we're in a culture that has no idea what it means to be human. We're fallen. We're fallen what? We're fallen from what? What does it mean to be a human being to begin with? We haven't answered that question real well, I don't think, because we've started with, you're a sinner. We've skipped right over the doctrine of the Imago Dei. Human beings, every human being bears the image of God, which means that every human being has intrinsic value and dignity. What's more, the cultural mandate gives further definition to both what a human is and what a human is for. Genesis 1:28, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. We're to have dominion. Now remember, this isn't domination. This is pre-fall. A good king loves his subjects. We're to have dominion. Beneficent rulers in imitation of our beneficent God whose image we bear. By the way, Ball State's logo is a sculpture of an angel named Beneficence. It's the last sculpture that David Chester French made. Do you know who David Chester French? What else did he make? Anyone?
Isn't it Lincoln?
The Lincoln Memorial, yeah. Yeah. His very last sculpture is Ball State, right in the center of Ball State's quad.
It's Indiana.
We are beneficent rulers, and we're to multiply and fill his garden kingdom. What God made is creation. What we're to make from that creation is culture. This is the cultural mandate. That's why J.R.R. Tolkien talks about us as sub-creators. It's kind of like if God sketched in the world. He sketched in the globe, and then he finally painted. He really beautifully painted in the Garden of Eden. And then he handed the palette and the brushes over to Adam and Eve. And he said, you guys finish it. I'm with you, right? It wasn't deism. It wasn't like, you know, stepping back. But it's your turn. Imitate me. Go and make, create, and spread this garden kingdom. It's what Richard Pratt talks about as the geographical and numerical expansion of the kingdom. Fill the world, expand the garden geographically, and then multiply numerically. We'll come back to that phrase in a minute here. And God looked at all that he made at this point, and he declared what? It's very good. The fall comes after that. You're a sinner comes after God made you in his image. So chapter 1 is what it means to be human. The creation. Chapter 2 is the fall. And chapter 3 then is redemption. Salvation through Christ. But what for? Just for personal piety? Did he die just to make you a moral individual? Well, good. Now you're a good guy. No, that's not the only reason. He's the second Adam. He's the Word made flesh. Just as creation was originally spoken into being, so it is again. He's setting all things back to rights. And then he gives the Great Commission, right? He gives his disciples this. And Jesus came and said to them, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you, and behold, I'm with you always to the end of the age. Now, I was in kind of traditional campus ministry for a while. And what I learned there, this was our mantra, kind of. and it was, but this is how it went, kind of. Go into all nations meant go on short-term mission trips and beach evangelism. And be sure you're always carrying the four spiritual laws and the bridge diagram in your back pocket. That was go into all the nations. Teach them to observe all that I've commanded you. All that I've commanded you. Tell them they're a sinner and they need me. That's all that I've commanded you. baptize them, give them a chance to kind of declare out loud what's happened to them. Make disciples. Help them to share the four spiritual laws and the bridge diagram with other people. And maybe have them go on staff with your ministry. And I'm with you always, even to the end of the age. Do it as soon as possible because the world's going to hell in a handbasket. That's kind of how, and it's a little tongue-in-cheek, right? But that's kind of how I learned to interpret this. But let's think a little more. Colossians 1, 15 through 17. I don't have it up here. Hebrews 1, 1 through 4. Both of those passages and others tell us that who created us? Jesus created us. Jesus created the world. Teach them all that I've commanded you. What was his first commandment? The cultural mandate. Expand the garden kingdom. That was his culture. That was his first command to us. The Great Commission, in fact, is just a restating of geographical and numerical expansion of the garden kingdom. So what? How does that play out, right? So now instead of just our two chapters that were chapter 2, which was you're a sinner or the fall, and chapter 3, which is redemption, now we have chapter 1, creation, and chapter 4, the consummation of the kingdom. Now we've got a creational telos. We know what man is from chapter 1, the Imago Dei, and we know what he's created for the consummation of the kingdom. Without those two chapters, it's very difficult to answer those two main questions that Eliot brings up. Not only that, but it puts us in a posture. So I began this by saying this is to help us with our posture towards the world around us. This puts us in a posture. One of recognizing, rather than looking at the world outside of our Christian subculture, and saying, as Alan Jacobs, I love this term. Anybody read Alan Jacobs, How to Think? If you haven't read that, read it. I told the bookstore downstairs to grab it. I think by tomorrow they'll have it. But How to Think, a survival guide for a world at odds, I think is the subtitle. Great little book, really helpful. He talks about the repugnant cultural other, right? When we see those people that aren't in our tribe and we don't understand them, how we can often think of them as the repugnant cultural other. They're different. When we begin with you're a sinner and you need to know Jesus so you can have personal piety, what that kind of, I think, does implicitly in us is, now I'm on the good side now. I've got the personal piety. You don't. You're a sinner, and if you don't listen, you're so there's the us and them kind of implicitly in this, right? What if we looked at everybody instead and said, you're the image of God? You're fallen, and I'm fallen, but you're the image of God. That changes some of our posture. Likewise, with the consummation, we're now not so much thinking in terms of just become morally pure and your moral impurity threatens mine, but instead we're thinking in terms of human flourishing. We're thinking in terms of you're the Imago Dei, you're fallen and I'm fallen, and I want to see you. I want to see what's best for you. I want the common good because you're the image of God, and I want to work towards what's best for you. Now, what is best for you? Well, you know, we'll get to that. This is a posture, and I'm not actually changing anything else. I still would say, what's best for you? Surrender to Jesus, right? We'll get there, but it's about the posture we have in getting there. I want us to kind of reframe thinking a little bit. Hans Ruckmacher was good friends with Schaeffer. He's an artist, art historian. I've heard this quote attributed to him long before the internet even. Here at Labrie often I've seen this. I haven't been able to find out where in his writing it is. If anybody knows, let me know. So I've just said it's attributed to him because I can't actually tell you where to find it. But even if he didn't say it, he should have. It's great. Jesus didn't come to make us Christians. Jesus came to make us fully human. Provocative, maybe. I don't think it should be, but it probably is a little bit. If Jesus created us in his image, and then we fell from that image, then what is redemption? Being recreated in his image. And what does it mean to be a human being? To be the image of God. The shift in perspective or posture, I think, is one of saying it's not about getting people on the right team or in my club or in my religion even. It's about helping them understand that they're not yet fully human. And that's what they want. They're just going about it all the wrong way. And I want to come alongside them and help them become fully human. So it's a posture. And I think it's an important posture when we're especially in the very polarized culture we're in today. All right, I'll stop there for a minute. I don't want to. I have another spot that we're going to stop. But any thoughts or questions on that I may or may not answer right now? Yes.
I just appreciate you pointing that out because it might be a way of responding to an era that we heard in the last plenary session, the contemporary expressionists and activists. People are really trying to figure out who they are,
mm-hmm.
to express that, and all that. So rather than seeing that as necessarily the downfall of all of our higher ed, we can see, well, what people need now is a story that helps
yes.
them figure out being fully human.
Exactly. That's why I'm hopeful is that Christians have what the questions that are being asked right now, we have the tools. And if we posture ourselves well, I think there are really hopeful places that we can, and we'll get into some practicals here in a minute and some things that I'm seeing happening. But yeah, that's exactly it. Yes.
Oh, what? How do we do that in terms of your engineering school, your school of architecture? How does that apply to
Yeah, great question. We'll get to some practicals here in a minute. Shortly, I'm glad you brought that. So for one is to have a. There are all kinds of practicals that we can do with something like this, right? But one is to have our architecture. I'm actually good friends with a couple of the architecture profs who are involved at the center, and having discussions with believing and unbelieving architecture profs together and just talking about what does it look like to think about city planning for human flourishing? And what presuppositions do you have that inform that? And why do they inform that? And allowing for a Christian worldview then to come to bear on those sorts of thoughts and have conversations along those lines.
I ask that because I live in Austin, Texas.
Okay. Yes, very much. That's an interesting question in all kinds of ways, and I have some other more specific thoughts on that, but I want to get through the theoretical, and then we'll get to some practicals, too, and then afterwards we can talk some more. But that's a great question. Okay, so part two here. Let's check my time. So part two, I'm calling prepare for upheaval. I'm trying to stick with the P thing. And so my P is capitalized. I hope you'll allow for that cheating. Is that okay? All right. So this is so Dan, you're talking about all this Christian-y stuff. That's great. But aren't you at a secular university? Aren't we talking about secular education? So what is this? Yes, I am. And yes, it'd be a lot easier if. We're only concerned with Christian higher education.
Not necessarily.
Well, not necessarily, but yes, I'd love to know what's behind that a little bit later. While I'm certainly hopeful of the place of Christian colleges, and in fact, we have a good relationship with some folks at Taylor U, which is just up the road from us, and I'm hopeful for the Christian universities in the higher education landscape. And if I thought there was a way, short of government coercion, to get all students to choose Christian university, I'd have to think about it. But I might think that's, I don't know. I don't know what I think of that. But that's not even, right, that's not happening. And at this point, I don't think abandoning the secular pluralist university is a responsible act of working for the welfare of the city. I don't see anywhere in Scripture an instance of those in exile, whether in Babylon or in Asia Minor, being instructed to form strictly Christian institutions other than the church itself. Now, I'm not saying. I don't think that that's bad, necessarily, to do that, right? To have Christian institutions. In fact, I just started a Christian institution called Alcuin Study Center, and I used to work at one called Schaefer Academy, and I think they're both great institutions. Yet to be seen whether the one I'm in right now is. The last one I think was great, for sure. But they are instructed, right? So the exiles weren't instructed to work in or to begin Christian institutions other than the church itself. They are instructed, though, to work with their hands, to live good lives among the pagans, so that to the degree that they ask for the hope that they have, right? 1 Peter 3:15, to honor earthly authorities and institutions and to work for the welfare of those around them. So what are the opportunities and how do we prepare for that? Well, part of those opportunities I think are coming our way through this upheaval, and I'm stealing that word from a book that's out called The Great Upheaval, Higher Education's Past, Present, and Uncertain Future by Levine and Van Pelt. Anybody familiar with that one? They don't have it downstairs. I asked them to have it down there. It's not. I'm sorry. These are not Christian authors that I know of. I don't know where they stand, but the book is not put out that way. They mainly discuss demographic, economic, and technological shifts. These are some of these underlying cracks or shifts that I'm talking about in the foundation that people are beginning to take note of, right? So here are these guys who are experts in higher education at large, and they're pointing out that there are these huge shifts happening and that the universities need to change or higher education is fundamentally in trouble right now, the great upheaval. So they're talking about demographic, economic, and technological shifts. Jonathan Haidt, probably many of you know, if you haven't bought The Coddling of the American Mind yet, it's downstairs on the book table. Do that. They're not paying me, by the way. I just think you should read a lot of good books. Jonathan Haidt, he also founded a thing called Heterodox Academy. Is anybody familiar with Heterodox Academy? Okay, good. Heterodox Academy is fantastic, and I'm going to talk more about that in a bit. He points to ideological shifts and social fragmentation in the culture and academy and calls for much-needed change. And then others, of course, have spoken about other shifts, mainly a lot about emotional shifts, depression brought on by the digital revolution as well as exacerbated maybe by the COVID pandemic. So if we looked at our last illustration, it might look like something... If we looked at our last illustration... that foundation that broke apart from the top and saw some of the smaller cracks maybe that were causing that, it might look something like this. Now it's shaking right now. In real life, that was where'd it go? It's not even, there it is, okay. So again, if this was on my Apple, we would have seen some real neat animation there. And so you might look at it something like this, or all these other little cracks, right? These are these smaller cracks. And again, this is where some opportunities coming in. There's I think this will be the last, I won't promise, but it might be the last book that I really push, and I am going to push this one. A Non-Anxious Presence by Mark Sayers. It's a little book. There are only two of them left down there. So get on and grab it fast. Fight your way to it. No. In A Non-Anxious Presence, How a Changing and Complex World Will Create a Remnant of Renewed Christian Leaders, Mark Sayers discusses how some of these same cultural shifts are creating opportunities for the church to have a voice in a pluralistic culture. He uses this illustration, this little anecdote, as kind of the center of the book. Let me read this to you. Think of it this way. he says, this is a long quote. You're in a room with a large group listening to a lecture given by officials. Halfway through the presentation, smoke begins to fill the place. Someone screams, fire! I didn't say that here. Someone screams, fire! Panic begins to grip the room. The exit seems to be blocked. All eyes turn to the officials in the front of the room. Yet they also seem overcome by the panic, and they cry and scream and shake. Then a woman emerges from the crowd, steadily walking up to the podium. In a calm but firm voice, she assures everyone that there is another exit at the back of the room, declares that everything will be okay, and asks people to leave via the door in the back calmly and in an orderly manner. In this scenario, who is the leader? Before the smoke appeared, most people would have said it was the officials standing at the front of the room that were the leaders. However, once the crisis arrived and the panic and anxiety swept through the room, the calm and non-anxious woman who addressed the crowd would be seen by most as the leader. The lesson: in an anxious, crisis-driven environment, the leadership leverage comes from a non-anxious presence. That woman wasn't known at all. Total stranger, invisible when this thing started. But in the upheaval, she had a solution and was able to step in to that confusion and meet the need. Sayers paints a historically informed picture of our time as, in his words, a gray zone. He says an era is characterized by centralized power and strongholds. We might think of the so-called American century, right, or something that where everyone kind of looked to the superpowers who were ruling the world, right? Ronald Reagan was at the top of his game, you know, however you want to look at that. And you have this era. But gray zones are what occurs between eras. When the former era's set of prevailing cultural assumptions and power structures are in late stage decline, and a network of competing ideas and tribes are scrambling to fill the void, we can look back and we can see what we've left behind. But we don't know yet where we're going to land. We're in the gray zone, phase two. We're in a wilderness. We're in exile. Levine and Van Pelt's book, The Upheaval, was recently assigned reading for the administration at Ball State. Its main message is this: many colleges and universities, especially in the East and Midwest, will fail unless they learn to adapt. They have a section in there called Looking Backward, in which they survey the landscape of higher education through the industrial revolutions of the 19th century and take what lessons they can learn from their observations and apply them to the digital revolution, exacerbated by the pandemic, that we find ourselves in today. They have another section there called Looking Sideways. They survey the landscape of the movie, music, and newspaper industries to see what education can learn from them. The idea that they say there is they claim that, like education, these three are information disseminating industries. Music, movie, and newspaper. They are information disseminating businesses. And if we had more time, we could discuss where those comparisons fall short and that perhaps there are some better comparisons. But they conclude that business-as-usual colleges should expect the same fate as Blockbuster, the CD, and the regional paper. They aren't wanting to spread mass hysteria, they say, but they very well may be contributing to the high blood pressure within the academy. They may be contributing to the anxiety. In an anxious, crisis-driven environment, the leadership leverage comes from the non-anxious presence. So in response to a survey question, I sent out a survey to a bunch of administrators and faculty members and other folks that work within higher ed just to get some ideas. A high-level administrator at a state university said, I think Christians have an amazing opportunity to model all of this right now. There's a void that is ready to be filled. Thoughtful Christians could have a major leadership role. Again, I'll pause for a couple, any questions or thoughts, and then I'm going to go on to part three, which is where we get a little more practical. And I say a little more because we're going to step towards the practical. I may have a couple concrete examples if we have time, but I want to leave some time for questions, and we're getting close to the end. So any questions or thoughts on that section? Fantastic. Oh, go ahead.
Mark Sayers is a secular person.
No, Mark Sayers is a pastor in Australia.
Sorry.
Doug Levine, not Doug Levine. What's his first name? Levine and Van Pelt. Anyone? Anyway, they at least come across as whatever, how we're going to say, but yeah, they're not in. They're not professing Christians in their book. So that book is from a secular perspective, but the Mark Sayers book is.
Okay, and the one you just mentioned, not Sayers, but the other one, is the one that the Ball State people need to read.
Right.
And that, I'm so sorry.
No, it's all right.
Are they both? Are you positing that they're both saying something similar or the same?
I'm saying that the Levine book, the for lack of a better term, the secular book. The distinctions kind of bother me some, but I know it's hard to get language. So that book is simply saying that there is an upheaval, that these cracks are evident to higher education at large, and change is necessary. And they're citing some of the same things in terms of why is all that change happening? What's the upheaval? What's the cultural disintegration that we see? And in that way, there's an overlap. That's where the Venn diagram kind of overlaps. Whereas Sayers is saying, yeah, there are all these. There is an upheaval in our culture, not just in education, but in all kinds of places. And that opens up the way for Christians who can be non-anxious, be the non-anxious presence to step in to those spaces. So I'm kind of applying Sayers' insight to the situation that Van Pelt and Levine see.
Sorry, but does Levine and all, do they have a solution?
They do. It's on. I'll get to that a little bit. That's a good question. One of the things that they say is it depends and then they say that in an interview actually is where I heard Levine speak later. I listened to a later interview, and he said that he spoke with I think it was an Ivy League, but one of the very top tier universities, and they said, "Well, yeah, we're doing everything we can. We're trying online and hybrid, and we're building up our dorms making it kind of this country club atmosphere to attract students." And he's like, he says, "Everybody's doing that. That's an ad hoc hodgepodge that's not going to get you any. What you need is you need to be unique. You need to figure out what's the identity of this university. And you need to offer something that others aren't offering." And this is the insight that a good friend of mine has. And I have to be careful here. an administrator at Ball State who is seeing that very thing and seeing that Ball State's having these conversations. And I recognize, again, I'm going to go back and say, I'm not going to have some grand answer for everybody. My hope here is to get the wheels turning, to get you thinking, in your context, what would this look like, right? I recognize I'm in the middle of Indiana, and while everywhere is affected by the liberalism and the all whatever however you want to put it, that's happening everywhere. Indiana is probably a little easier to deal with some of these things than other places. I get that. I also know though that there's some amazing stuff happening at places like Duke. Talk to the folks at Anselm, what's happening at University of Minnesota. There are things happening at many universities that are cause for hope. And I think there are ways, again. So we'll keep going here. But that's one of the things he says is this idea of I already said that one, I think, didn't I? Yeah, I think Christians have an amazing opportunity. I just read that, didn't I? Yeah, okay. Great. So let's get practical here. Part three. Pray and provide. Pray first. Provide, in other words, provide some solutions, even if it's proximately, right? The proximate good is still good. And I recognize that what I'm going to suggest here is, and what I am suggesting, is that we work with the universities for their welfare. There are still many people there. They're not all evil, we want to tear down Western civilization people, right? That's I think we need to be really careful of not kind of too broad brush demonizing. And again, going back to that posture, right, that I think is really crucial in the way we approach some of this. But recognizing, even if they don't have the same ultimate end, just because they're not all Christians, and they're not all saying, well, we're doing this for the glory of God. You know, what's the purpose of man? Well, to love God and enjoy him forever, right? Yes, but between here and there, there are a lot of other proximate ends that are good, that are common good, right? And so thinking in terms kind of in a Kuyperian way of common grace, are there some ways that we can work with them? And I think there are. One of those ways, civility is one of these cracks that is so obvious. This is where Heterodox Academy and Jonathan Haidt in The Coddling of the American Mind, Coddling of the American Mind, he points out all kinds of stories of and he's by the way, self-proclaimed left, leaning left, liberal, non-Christian. He's a sociologist at NYU, okay? So NYU is a far haul from central Indiana, and he's saying, look, my own tribe, my own people are making it very difficult to have any real discussion on campus, because everybody's so quickly demonized or canceled, right? And there's no civility, and students who are offended by some professor are running them out. Have you guys read what happened at Evergreen? I don't know how recently that was, but look up Evergreen. That's a fascinating story. The students, mobs, are just running faculty out in places. Not everywhere, but some places.
An evolutionary biologist.
Yeah. For one word that, yeah, anyway, yeah, yeah. So civility, huge thing. And now, this is Alcuin of York. And we don't really know what he looked like. But this is a woodcut of Alcuin of York. Craig Yingst is the artist. You should look him up, spelled with a K, K-R-E-G, Yingst. I just liked his artwork a lot. He does other saints. I've got a St. Augustine on my wall at home. And then I just contacted him and asked if he'd make an Alcuin for me for our center. And he said, yeah. So this is him. And one of my favorite quotes from Alcuin is, irrigate their lands with learning. But another thing I love, here's why Alcuin Study Center is named Alcuin. Here's one of the reasons. Is this story of Alcuin meeting Charlemagne. So Charlemagne asked Alcuin to be his main educator. And when Alcuin came from the British Isles over to Gaul, to the Aachen, the palace at Aachen, Charlemagne said, you're the best educator I know, and I want my kingdom to be not only powerful but well-educated. You're my guy. You're going to lead the palace school. And Alcuin says, essentially, it's a little paraphrase, but you got to stop cutting people's heads off just because they're not Christians. That's not the gospel. And Charlemagne was like, really? What do you do then? And Alcuin said, well, you educate them. And you have civil dialogue and discussion, and you let the Holy Spirit do his thing. Charlemagne's like, huh. Okay, you're in. He could have chopped his head off, honestly. This is a little more nuanced version. This is from Dominion by Tom Holland. Another great book. Faith arises from the will, not from compulsion, so wrote Alcuin, who in 781 had met Charlemagne and was recruited to his court. Pagans, he urged the king, should be persuaded, not forced to convert. Let peoples newly brought to Christ be nourished in a mild manner as infants are given milk, for instruct them brutally, and the risk then, their minds being weak, is that they will vomit everything up. Alcuin's conviction that there was no improvement so radical that it might not be achieved by education was precisely why Charlemagne had employed him. For without knowledge, no one can do good. Increasingly in the depths of the Frankish countryside, there was no aspect of existence that Christian teaching did not touch. Civil conversation. I use that story when I introduce us at various events on campus. And one of them that I'm going to tell you about here in a minute is one of the most striking. But I've had whole rooms full of people, some Christians, some not, often a lot of very obviously, just a wide range of worldviews sitting in front of me. And when I say this, that Alcuin said, yeah, we shouldn't cut off people's heads because for believing the wrong things. And we've named Alcuin this because we're in an age where everybody wants to cut each other's heads off for not believing the same things. And that's not helpful. And I get a bunch of nods. Everybody. Yeah, we get it. We don't want that. We want civil discussion. Not just Christians. A whole heck of a lot of people want civil discussions. We need to model that. We need to help others to do that well. But that's a huge need. Heterodox Academy, I've mentioned a few times. I'm going to stay back here for just a second. Just so you don't get distracted with a new quote. So Jonathan Haidt started this thing. Look it up online, heterodoxacademy.com, I think it is, and HXA is their little logo. They are, it's growing by leaps and bounds. As professors, you can become members with it. You can write for it. And the whole idea is heterodox, meaning not following. Well, Jonathan Haidt had one of his articles that's, he has tons, but one of the ones that has been the most kind of bounced around lately and was just recently reprinted version of it in the Chronicle of Higher Education and got slammed hard there. And again, this guy's not a believer, a self-proclaimed left-leaning sociologist. And he says, you can either have ideology you or truth you. You can't have both. The minute that an administration tells us what belief system that we can or can't proclaim, then they've just limited the questions we can ask, and we can no longer pursue truth where it's found. This is an unbeliever at NYU, and he's got it. There's a groundswell of support right now for Heterodox Academy. Some great stuff happening there. Right? He understands we need civil dialogue between competing worldviews to find truth. Yes, sir.
Yes, I appreciate all your thought and work towards this and the Alcuin Institute. I want to say, by background, I was born, raised, and educated in the Midwest. All my degrees are from Midwestern institutions. However, I'm a professor in the University of California system.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't come here for the weather, but I came here for encouragement and information.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate not being asked biographical information, but I will tell you my university system, all nine campuses, is conquered and occupied territory.
Yeah.
What we would like to have in terms of civil discussion, reasoned discourse, and the old tradition that the academy is present for the reasoned discussion of ideas in a free marketplace is dead. These civil discussions do not occur.
Mm-hmm.
On the campuses and where I work, we have more of a cancel culture.
Mm-hmm.
We have hirings, tenure, promotion, and especially administrative appointments made through a certain ideological screen, and it's getting more and more serious.
Yeah.
And I'm just very concerned about, particularly in institutions such as mine, who tend to be cultural leaders, what are we to do? I am a member of Heterodox Academy.
Okay.
I devour their material regularly.
Yeah.
But I'm in a very dark environment.
Yeah, you are.
And would appreciate any ideas and suggestions you have beyond that.
I don't know that I'm qualified, honestly, to give you a whole lot.
Okay.
I'd love to hear, but one thought is that there are certain pockets, and I think chief among them is the one you're in, that are going to be much later in. I think there's going to be adoption of some of the Heterodox Academy approach in universities, and I think there are a lot of opportunities for that, and it's happening already in places where universities have as many professors that are involved in heterodox or that sort of thing as aren't. right? I think that's going to happen, and it's and I think it's will California be at the end of that wave or not?
Six members of the Heterodox Academy on my campus.
Yeah.
It's a start.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, right.
And
I just think, yeah, so my only, from my vantage point, all I can see is that that's a really dark corner, and we all need to be praying for you and for that area, and that I think just as these waves come, that it's going to, short of a miracle, probably be at the back end of a wave, if at all. I don't know. You know, I don't have a one size fits all solution. But I think, I don't know. I hope that there's some things that will bounce around and maybe help you to kind of think with some of those folks that are with Heterodox that you're with, what that could come to.
Can I just interject on that?
Yeah.
I think the wonderful thing with this approach is you're actually fighting for free speech.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You're not fighting for your Christian
life. Right.
You're not fighting for philosophical positions. How many people are more likely to jump on free speech?
They would, yeah, yep, yep. It's oppressive. No, that is, that's exactly it. Yeah, that is the.
But
that is the argument.
I
think the more that we can promote, not, but there are some others. So another, and these are who I'd, so height is one I think using Schaefer's old language of co-belligerent, right? Which I like and don't like. And I don't like, we shouldn't be belligerent toward other people, right? But being belligerent toward bad ideas, and I think that's more what he's getting at. And we find others who want to see change. So height is one of those. Another one is Barry Weiss, Bari. It's a woman. She's, what's that? Yeah, yeah, and now she has the Free Press, which Megan Phelps Roper writes for her. Megan Phelps Roper was once with the Westboro Baptist, and Barry Weiss is a lesbian, and she interviews. She also has a podcast called Honestly. And on her, one of the very first podcast I heard by her, this is what caught my attention, was the book, I can't remember the author, but the book called Irreparable Damage. It's about how the transgender movement is destroying our daughters, something like that. And Barry Weiss interviewed this woman in the most generous listening way. So here, a lesbian listening to the arguments of this and said, "Yeah, you're right, right? And this has gone. There's something." And they, Barry Weiss is very much, and the Free Press is very much about competing worldviews, or not competing, different worldviews. And in one sense, they are competing, right? Obviously, but in dialogue.
I think Camille Paget is also a person.
Okay. Okay, Camille Paget, I don't know. I'm not familiar with her. And then there are Christians in that are also doing this sort of thing in the main line. I think it's often we're like, well, Christians are shut out. No, they're not. They're more and more. Tish Harrison Warren writes the New York Times and the Atlantic. David French writes for the Atlantic. You've got, David Brooks, who basically shared his conversion story through his books and his columns. He's been with the New York Times forever. And he became a Christian like in his late 60s or something, or mid-60s, probably not in late 60s, but later in life. And talks about being basically a baby Christian and how humbling it is to not really know as much as, you know, he thought he should by this time. That's for a guy who writes for the New York Times and has forever, to be that epistemologically humble, that's huge. And he's married. You probably know Ann Snyder is his wife, and she's the editor of Comment magazine. And if you're not familiar with Comment magazine, get familiar with it. It's fantastic. They're great. Hedgehog Review. So let me go into. Actually, I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm going to skip that slide because we're out of time, really, and not quite. Okay. Let me give you a little bit of Poncet's here, Pascal's Poncet's. I'll just read this part. Make good men... no, I'll go back to the whole quote. It's good. Men despise religion. That's the 17th century, but it's so good right now. Men despise religion. They hate it and are afraid it may be true. The cure for this is first to show that religion is not contrary to reason, but worthy of reverence and respect. Next, make it attractive. Make good men wish it were true, and then show that it is. Worthy of reverence because it really understands human nature. Attractive because it promises true good. I just highlight the last two lines of that here. Make good men wish it were true, and then show that it is. Worthy of reverence because it really understands human nature. Attractive because it promises true good. Some examples of how that can happen. So here, not only being civil, but having integrity in our work. Jump way ahead. James Davison Hunter, probably familiar with that name, some of you maybe. To Change the World is a book that he wrote, as well as Culture Wars. And he is a sociologist at University of Virginia. He spoke to a group of students when I was in seminary. He came down and spoke with our class, and we had lunch with him, and he said, he had become the chair of the sociology department. He said his peers, and that was a peer appointed position. His peers elected him, not because they had the same worldview. Instead, he went through all the different worldviews of the, you know, he's like, here's who I work with. They didn't elect me because they believed the same thing as me. In fact, we have completely different beliefs, competing beliefs, and they know it. He's an outspoken Christian. They elected me because I work my tail off for them. I try to make them successful at what they do. Working for the good of others, working for their welfare, tends to get you a voice. Again, if we go back to that 2-chapter versus 4-chapter, often as Christians we want to say, you got to believe the right things. And once you believe the right things, then we can work together. And that's backwards. If we can work for people and with people. Another example of this is from right here in town. And this happened. Kayla Nixon. Some of you know Kayla Nixon. She was a gynecological surgeon. She was trained, what I get mixed up with the layers of things. Was it a fellowship? Was it a residency that she did as a fellow? One of those at Mayo. In the midst of getting her medical degree, she decided she needed to be more well-rounded, so she took a year off and went off to the Pratt Institute of Art and got a master's degree in art history and then came back and finished up her medical degree. And then she is now at Rush Medical Center, and she's a professor there, and she's also a gynecological surgeon there in Chicago. She came down to Ball State, spoke on behalf of the Alcuin Study Center. We had her in the student center. She spoke to IU medical students there, and she spoke about ethics and a Christian worldview from a gynecological surgeon's perspective, using Nancy Piercy, her book on the body, as her framework for ethics, and said, that you don't have to. She's a very successful gynecological surgeon, and she refuses to do abortions or transgender surgeries. And her peers and colleagues, many of whom do those things, love her. And they have a great relationship, and they know where she stands. And she works hard in every way she can that doesn't violate her convictions to support them and to make them successful. And that gives her all the more leeway. And she went into this in great detail because there were two young women, IU medical students, who are sitting in the second row, and one of them is weeping, and the other one's hugging her. And these two young women say, we're both in on track to be in gynecology, and we're both ready to quit because the pressures are so great to fold on our convictions, to compromise. And we feel like there's no way that we can go into this without, as a Christian. And she said, no. And she gave them her personal information, she continues to stay in contact with them, and they they sat there and talked to her and learned about how do you navigate these things? How have you done this? In fact, that's one of three instances now that we've had Christian medical professionals at conferences at Ball State, either through Zoom or live at Alcuin, where now they're having those kinds of conversations, but then they're also giving their personal information for networking. So then we're working for the welfare of the university, right? The university saying, wait, you're bringing Mayo Clinic and CHOPS and Rush and Riley and Duke. You're bringing those folks here, and they're giving their personal information for our students to get to network and maybe get jobs there. Well, say whatever you want to say. You know, do whatever you want if because that's helping them, right? There are some common good. There's the proximate, and if we can meet and work together on the proximate, we can make headway in other ways. That's another one of those areas. They're concerned about the economics. It's all about getting a job. Well, great. That's actually an opportunity for us. We can help those people get jobs and in the meantime open up avenues. We're doing the same thing with Plow. Plow Publishing, you know Plow Magazine? So their editorial team has agreed to come in and teach a seminar course, not a whole course, but to be guest lecturers via Zoom with our journalism department. And just so happens that the head of our journalism department is a believer. Plow, Plough. And it's a great ecumenical, in the best sense of that word, arts and intellectual magazine, beautifully put together. It's really professional. And so to have an editorial team that's that professional and coming to speak to, say, a freshman or one of the big, my degree from Ball State was magazine journalism, and that's the journalism department is a very celebrated part of Ball State, And so the to have that editorial team come in, well, then they also, though, happen to have internships available, and they're going to be talking about their worldview, of course, because that's what the magazine is, and they're going to give away free magazines to these students. But they're also networking with them and giving them opportunity to find jobs, right? So that sort of playing into the places where, so yeah, has higher education lost its telos and it's all about just getting a job? That's an opportunity for us. That's a gap for us to step into. That's a place where we can work with that, right? So I had a few other things here, but when it comes to if I can just give you three more slides and then we'll be done. This is from the end of a longer piece by Dorothy Sayers, no relation to Mark Sayers, who I saw it earlier. Her essay, Why Work. And when it comes to this idea of James Davison Hunter or of Kalyn Nixon doing excellent work, that's what gave them a voice, right? And she says, the whole thing is, she says this, in nothing has the church so lost her hold on reality as in her failure to understand and respect the secular vocation. She's allowed work and religion to become separate departments and is astonished to find that as a result, the secular work of the world is turned to purely selfish and destructive ends. And that the greater part of the world's intelligent workers have become irreligious, or at least uninterested in religion. But is it astonishing? How can anyone remain interested in a religion which seems to have no concern with 9/10 of his life? The church's approach to an intelligent carpenter is usually confined to exhorting him not to be drunk and disorderly in his leisure hours and to come to church on Sundays. What the church should be telling him is this, that the very first demand that his religion makes upon him is that he should make good tables. Church, by all means. Decent forms of amusement, certainly. But what use is all of that if at the very center of his life and occupation he's insulting God with bad carpentry? No crooked table legs or ill-fitting drawers ever, I dare swear, came out of the carpenter's shop at Nazareth. Nor, if they did, could anyone believe that they were made by the same hand that made heaven and earth? And then she ends with this, no piety in the worker will compensate for work that's not true to itself, for any work that is untrue to its own technique is a living lie. There are so many more pieces I could give you, but I think I want to say that this discipleship is another practical thing. The church needs to start early. Teach, another thing, I think it's Sayers that says, teach Monday morning on Sunday morning. Right? We think of discipleship, again, in these, I think, very much in a two-chapter kind of a way, in a personal piety kind of a way. We don't think of discipleship as full-orbed, thick thinking. We need to start there much, much earlier. And the last two things here. Stephen Loomis, an author, he's talking with Ken Myers of the Mars Hill Audio Journal. Great stuff. Totally different from the wacky Mars Hill. And Stephen Loomis, in this conversation, he says, if you hold to a strong sense of teleology of the created world, again, we're back to that four-chapter gospel, teleology of the created world, then it changes the way in which we go about the project of teaching and discipleship. And Ken Myers responds, I wonder if part of the problem for Christians is that their understanding of redemption doesn't include a teleology of the created world. I think that's dead on. And is this risky? Is what I'm proposing risky to be in the university? Say you're a Christian. Don't back down from being a Christian in the university and then listen to others really well and work for the good of others really well. This is what I'm seeing amongst my the faculty that I work with and what they're doing and saying and making headway in ways that is just beautiful. And is it risky? Yeah. But another quote from Ken Myers is, since when is attenuating risk an essential aspect of Christian discipleship? Mitigating. Lessening. Yes. Yes. Since when is attenuating risk an essential aspect of Christian discipleship? So as one person told me recently, it seems as though we need to maybe also have a theology of getting fired. How's that for a hopeful place to end? Any questions or thoughts?
Gordon Rayner?
No, I'll write it down then.
He talks a lot about working, as Christians, working to do the most excellent work we can do in whatever we do, for the glory of God and the good of others.
Yeah. Good. I'll look him up. Thanks. Ethan.
I would say equally we should probably be ready to be fired, but possibly if we are seeing the good of people that are non-Christians being droned out of our churches as well.
Hmm. I'd like to hear more on that, but I want to give others. Yeah, go ahead. They were looking sideways at that to say, what happened to them during the digital revolution? And they were ahead of the curve, right? So Netflix replaced Blockbuster. Well, you've got the university, they haven't been looking at the digital revolution as they're way behind the curve. And if they don't change something quick, they're going to go the way of Blockbuster.
Yeah, I'm just curious, has there been any insights on few people who are starting to look into that and say, how can the university learn from the few who survive in those other industries?
Yeah. And one of them is this idea of, one is you've got the massive online open courses, right? Coursera, which is just ginormous. They go into this whole thing of competencies are replacing credits. Right, so you can go just about anywhere and get kind of a check a box, and it's pass fail. Oh, you can do this skill because it's more and more skill based. You have the skills; it's job training, right? In fact, industries are constantly lobbying at universities all the time to say we want you to give this course because we'll hire students that have taken this set of courses. And it's essentially what used to be on the job training, right? But now they're saying no, you do it over here. Which is leading in healthier universities is leading to this interesting conversation about is that what we want to be? Is that all we want to be? Or do we want to educate the whole person? I know we're almost done. If you need to leave. I want to share this. So what we're talking about right now is at Ball State, you drive down. The Ball State's saying we want to teach the whole person. We want to train the whole person. Well, how do you do that if you aren't willing to acknowledge that spirituality is part of that, right? Not only part of that, it's actually foundational to that, right? if you drive down I-69 in Indiana, you'll see billboards for Ball State, for Anderson University, which is a Christian university, Indiana Wesleyan Christian University, Taylor University. You'll see all those right in a row. And so if you're a Christian family and you're driving down there, chances are you're looking at that and saying, well, there are three possibilities for my kid to grow in his faith and one possibility for him to lose his faith. And I'm not saying it's true, but that's what is, it's a very likely scenario. And the thing is that Ball State's about a third the price of the other three and has probably much better, in many cases, not always, but much better programs, depending on what you're going into, but a lot of really good programs. What if Ball State, on that billboard, said, educating the whole person, Ball State in conjunction with Alcuin Study Center, the Hillel Institute, so you've got all the different religious groups. Now, of course, you're going to say, whoa, that sounds real, like coexist kind of, right? Real relativistic. Well, we're in a pluralist setting. But can you imagine then if on their brochures, the things they send out to parents, they had, here are your options for, we're formally teamed up. They already recognize all of us as student groups. We're already recognized. They just kind of say, yeah, you can do your thing on here. You're recognized. We're not going to like advertise that you're with us, right? What if they did? What if they said, here are your options, parents. You're coming from a Christian perspective. You're coming from a Jewish perspective. You're coming from these places, and you want your kid to have a full life, a full orbed education. We're formally teaming up with these folks to do these things. So you check what you're interested in, and then when they come, not part of their Ball State tour could be a tour of Alcuin Study Center as well. And we talk about how are these things connecting. And that's educating the whole person. That's also answering the question somebody asked earlier, but of this idea of becoming universities that have a unique way of educating, right? They're not just trying a little bit of everything, but, oh, wow, that's a whole new idea. I think there's reason to believe that in some places that's a real possibility, that kind of partnership could happen. So that didn't really answer your question, but it totally. But the idea of because we're in this place of competencies and credit versus credits, and it's this buffet of whatever you want. It's also just in time versus just in case is another thing they talk about. So now you can get your competencies just in time for your job. It's just job training. So you just find out, oh, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm 30 years old, and I'm changing jobs, and now I know what I want to do, and so I'm just going to go and grab whatever competencies I need so I can tell these folks I've got my certificate. And that's another one, is certificates over diplomas, over degrees. That actually works in our favor in some ways as well. Programs, so we're offering a certificate program. So when you're in a world where it's just about the competencies, well, now you've got a bunch of employees who have all the same competencies. Skill set here, skill set here. How do we choose? Oh, he's got some certificates from some interesting places. He's done some interesting other work, and that gives him an edge over this person who just has the skills, but they haven't really done anything to develop themselves. So this guy's got, I've never heard of Alcuin Study Center, but he's got a certificate in Christian thought from them. Let's look into that. Right? So certificates are actually, they're bearing a lot of weight in the professional world right now. That's a whole new thing. So that's part of another thing that they're looking at is the way things are changing. And so universities are trying to figure out how do we adapt to this changing market that these other industries already have, and that's some of what they're coming up against and playing with some of these ideas. Online possibilities, a more buffet kind of a thing, smaller just-in-time education instead of this four-year, well, just in case these 4 years are helpful for my degree or out for a job someday, because they don't see it as formation. They just see it as, yeah, maybe it'll be relevant to a job. Well, if it's not, I don't know. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. Just in case, that's a lot of money for just in case. I'm going to wait and do it just in time. Yes?
I maybe missed something with my bathroom break, but I wanted to observe that according to the statistics now, 55% of university enrollments nationwide are female.
Yeah.
It seems to indicate a trend that men are increasingly saying, I don't want the time and expense.
Yep.
I'm just going to get my skill and go into the job market.
That's true, actually, and especially with stuff in high schools, the trade schools are growing like crazy, and especially that you can now get certified to be a welder in high school. My son's actually doing that right now. Yeah, that's fascinating, right? So by the time he's the summer after his senior year, he'll have an associate's degree in welding.
Sometimes I think that we as Christians also isolate ourselves. My dad was a cattle dealer for 50 years in Minnesota. I grew up in the sale barns. He never spoke about anything about his faith in his business. Nobody ever knew. All they knew that Abe went to church.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that that if Abe had a family gathering going on, they were probably going to be invited. If they wanted a place to go for dinner, Abe and Ruth would probably invite them over and they'd come to dinner.
Yeah.
And we handled from 75 to 150 head of cattle a week through our place. All they knew that was that Abe went to church. And I have a rather funny story, if you can wait, but there was a cattle dealer that owned the sale barn, and he was a rough, tough cattle guy. Big hat, heavy set guy. He talked with a lisp like this, he had a cigar in his mouth and a whip. And Billy Graham had been on television that night before, during the sale, or before the sale. And my dad is at the sale barn the next day. And this fellow in the middle of the sale walks up to my dad along the ring, and he said, Abe, he said, I looked into that preacher last night on television. He said, that son of a bitch is all right. My dad saw it as the working of the Holy Spirit. As the working of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
And so sometimes we are so afraid of sin. We're so afraid, but all we really have in common with the world is our sin. We don't have our salvation, we have our sin. And when the world sees us, they go, saint. They say, no,
I see what you're saying, yeah. Being willing to be vulnerable, basically,
real.
Yeah, we are, that's good, it's good. Yeah.
And he was known as a reputable cattleman.
Yeah. Thank you all very much.